Welcome to the Millennial Therapist Podcast with Mao and Nao.
This podcast is hosted by two millennial therapists who are true crime, forensic psychology, and macabre obsessed.
This is not your typical mental health podcast where only mental health and social work topics are discussed. We dabble in various topics from cultural humility to military mental health to ghosts to interesting ways our parents use the paranormal to discipline us. El cucuy, anyone?
Why so many topics? Because we're millennials. To make things more interesting, one is an Air Force veteran and a mom of two. The other is currently serving active duty. And both are children of immigrants working to honor their ancestors. Warning, listener discretion is advised. Hello, thank you for joining us at MTP with Mao and Nao, your favorite millennial therapist pair. If this is your first time, welcome and please subscribe and share. If you're returning, welcome back, gorgeous. This is Mao speaking and that is Nao. Before we get started on today's episode, we wanted to give a big thank you to Sitting Bull College's Bachelor of Social Work program, their students, and director Alicia and Professor Leslie. We had a chance to meet the social work students and answer any questions they had about social work and the field and what it really looked like once you graduated. It really inspired us to continue to do what we do and keep fighting the fight. So we were really, really grateful for the opportunity to be part of that. So thank you again to the Sitting Bull College. And thank you so much to James and Robert Welsh of the Double Cleanse podcast for having me, Mao, on their Trolls and Tribulations episode where we explored the psyche of internet trolls and haters. James and Robert have a joint YouTube channel, The Welsh Twins. In addition to their own individual channels, you can find James discussing skincare tips, science, debunking trendy TikTok and Instagram tips. Robert is a professional makeup artist of over 10 years and discusses makeup theory and proper techniques that really work. He also has a great ghost and makeup every other Monday series, so please check them out if you haven't already. All right, Nao, what do we have for the folks today?
So today we're going to talk about an iconic hero of mine, and I think I can speak for almost all Latinos when I say that she is truly an icon, an idol, and forever changed our lives. So today's podcast is dedicated to the queen of Tejano music, Selena. You know, and this is in her honor. I grew up with her music. I saw the movie. I heard like what it was like, people that actually got to experience her at the height of her fame. Like, and even till today, her music is played on almost every single radio station. Not even like if it's just Latinos, radio stations in Spanish, but just all over the world. So today we'll be dedicated.
Totally agree. Like, I grew up with Selena's music, and even me being like this little Asian girl in Massachusetts, like far from Texas and Tejano and Mexican culture, she was everything. And I think that really speaks to her stardom power, where she connected so many people. Yeah, just untimely death of hers was just so heartbreaking. And we were so young at that time too, that like we couldn't really grasp like, what the fuck, people like that die? She was so famous, and it was just such a really shitty situation.
Yeah, and I was gonna ask Ness, like, how did you know about Selena?
Back in the day, right, before MTV really started, me and my cousins had this little TV in the kitchen. There was something almost like a TV guide-esque type of music channel. And I don't know if it was just local to the New England area, but you could like pay like $1 or $2 to request music videos, right? Like, you actually had to fucking pay. It was no TRL. Me and my cousins broke ass. Like, we was not paying. So we would literally have it on all day hoping for somebody to pay for a video. And every time there was a video, it was almost always Selena. So that's how we were able to see her. And then, you know, she died in 95, and Selena's movie came out starring J-Lo not that long after.
Yeah, fun fact, I read somewhere that J-Lo actually competed with 22,000 other actresses, or either 2,000 or 22,000 other ones. So she landed the role. So who is Selena? So Selena is known for being the queen of Tejano music. And I read in some other websites that she has also been referred to as the Mexican Madonna. No. But let me stop you right there in your tracks, because no person of color that has dominated their field is the Mexican this or the Latino that. Selena is Selena, Selena forever, okay? Selena is the first in everything that she has done. Yes, both of us. So I was watching a stand-up comic, and her name is Cristina Alonso. In her stand-up, she says, for those of you that don't know Selena, Selena is the closest thing Latinos have to a superhero. She's a Mexican-American singer. She died over 20 years ago, and we still talk about what she could have done. Oh, if Selena was here,
yeah.
Unfortunately, when she has passed away, she was at the height of her career. So it was so heartbreaking. Cardi B also references Selena in the song Motorsport featuring Migos and Nicki Minaj. And she says, let me wrap my weave up. I'm the trap Selena. So when I start my day, I like to think I want to be the social work Selena. We're going to put that on t-shirts. So Selena was born on April 16, 1971 in Lake Jackson, Texas, about 50 miles away from Houston. She was born to Abraham Jr. and Marcela Quintanilla. She was the youngest of three siblings, Avi Quintanilla and Suse Quintanilla. So her father, being a musician himself, at 9 years old, he saw Selena's talent and he formed the band Selena y Los Dinos in 1981. So she became the lead singer and Avi was playing the guitar and Suse was playing the drums. They would play on the weekends in her family's restaurants and also at weddings and at parties. She went on to graduate from the American School of Correspondence, and when she was 17, she was enrolled to the Pacific Western University. When Selena was 12, the band recorded their first song and went on to record their first album. They accepted Chris Pérez, the band's guitarist, who would become Selena's husband in secret in 1992. So she was only 22 years old when she married Chris. The movie Selena goes on to describe at how much odds the father and Chris Pérez were. And it describes all the drama, and J-Lo is the one that depicts Selena in the movie. The father didn't want her to marry Chris. That's a whole nother podcast for a whole nother chisme. So we can cover that another day. Selena's accolades and rise to fame vary because of how talented she was. She was a singer slash songwriter slash business owner slash clothes designer. These are just a few of her many accomplishments. And according to the Encyclopedia of World Biography, in 1988, she was voted the Female Artist of the Year at the Tejano Music Awards. Her song with Alvaro Torres, Buenos Amigos, went on to become the number one on the Billboard's Latin chart. In February 1994, more than 60,000 people saw her perform in Houston at the Houston Astrodome, which broke the records for audiences for that locale. In March 1994, her album Selena Live won a Grammy Award for the Best Mexican-American Album. She was also nominated in 1995 for Best American Performance for her album Amor Prohibido. Selena's growing fame also increased record sales. In July 1994, Selena released Amor Prohibido. The album would sell more than 1 million copies. It was the top-selling Latin album of the year. It was also named the Tejano Music Awards Album of the Year. Selena and her siblings' first language was actually English. So in the movie, they talk about how she can't even roll her R's, and then she learns to because she wants to sing in Spanish. That's not an easy feat, you guys. Like, that's pretty big. In Latino cultures, or especially in the United States, there's a history in which Latinos were punished in school. They were given corporal punishment for not speaking English. So therefore, there's a lot of generations that don't go on to teach their children because the Spanish language was stigmatized. They just didn't perform Tejano music. They would perform for different audiences in multiple genres. So, you know, this was a very talented group. Her growing success in multiple ventures, it's really not a surprise that her fan base had a growing love for Selena and her family. One of her biggest ventures was a clothing boutique she opened in Texas. They included original clothing, jewelry, and salon services. And according to biography, the boutiques were experiencing some financial setbacks, but Selena was very hopeful and was really dedicated to have the boutiques grow, that she was also hopeful that she can open up a clothing bag factory in Monterrey, Mexico. Let's jump to 1 month before her death. At that point, she was at the height of her career, and with all these accomplishments under her belt, Selena was working really hard on an English language album that would allow her to become a crossover superstar like Gloria Estefan, according to biography. 3 weeks before her death, there was a big dispute between Selena and Yolanda Saldivar. Yolanda Saldivar was in charge of the fan club that she managed for Selena. And Mal will talk a little bit more how this relationship came to be. As Yolanda was the founder of Selena's fan club, she helped manage the boutiques and the clothing factory Selena wanted to open. Given her work with the fan club, she had earned the trust of Selena and her family, and this resulted in being promoted to managing the boutique. But this is where there was a falling out on the horizon. Her dad had heard from multiple complaints from the fan club members that they were not getting the stuff that they paid for. So on March 9th, 1995, Selena, along with her father and her sister, confronted Yolanda about her management of the boutiques. And at that time, Yolanda couldn't really explain the inconsistencies that Selena and her family were addressing with her. That wasn't the end of the conversation. Selena went on to address Yolanda's behaviors. She was informed by some of the boutique employees that they believed that Yolanda had taken some money from the store in San Antonio. Things were starting to escalate. Let's talk about 2 weeks before her death. Selena had learned a lot of troubling things at this point, but she still, you know, she still worked with Yolanda, and she trusted her to some degree, that she allowed for her to have some access to some of the financial accounts. This is when Selena also discovers that there was some financial records missing, and rightfully so, she wanted Yolanda to return them. So in 2012, her husband wrote a memoir detailing his life with Selena. It's called To Selena with Love. He talks about how Selena met with Yolanda on March 15 to try to get the missing paperwork related to the financial records she had been asking for. The encounter occurred in Selena's car, and Yolanda gave up some of the documents. So, big red flag here. Yolanda proceeded to show Selena a gun that she was keeping in her purse. Chris goes on to describe that Selena, unbothered by this, tells Yolanda to return the gun. And it seemed like she actually did return the gun, and she listened to Selena. One of the things that they talk about is that she had purchased the .38 on March 11, and after a background check, she picked it up on March 13, and after meeting with Selena, looks like she took back the revolver. So now we're heading towards a week before Selena's death, and then a few things happen here. Although there was this falling out with Yolanda because of how shady she's being, Selena continues to work hard on the crossover album that she wants, and she's recording this in Tennessee. So she spent some time in the studio in Corpus Christi, and then she went to Tennessee to continue to record. She was working with Keith Thomas, who's a songwriter and producer, and they were working on her most popular hit, I Could Fall in Love. And as soon as I was reading that from the sources, I swear to you, like, the song came on my head. Because it's so popular, such a touching song. On March 30th, Yolanda called Selena to let her know that she had the rest of her paperwork that Selena had been asking for. So being the sus that she is, Yolanda asked Selena to go by herself to meet her. No, thank you. You kind of did a flex on me last time, showing me a nice little gun in your purse. So Chris went with Selena to the Days Inn where Yolanda was staying at in Corpus Christi. In her typical nature and typical fashion, she only gave Selena partial documentation. And this is where I hand off to Mal to talk about a little more about Yolanda Saldivar.
Yolanda then called Selena saying that she had been raped in Mexico and again told Selena to come along to the motel. Chris told Selena to tell Yolanda that it was too late, but she secretly agreed to meet with Yolanda the following morning. The next day, around 9 a.m., Selena left Chris sleeping in bed and headed to meet Yolanda alone. And at the motel, Selena demanded the financial papers. Yolanda at that time delayed handing it over by again claiming that she had been raped in Mexico. Selena, being kind-hearted and a caring person, drove Yolanda to Doctors Regional Hospital where doctors found no evidence of rape. The two women then returned to the motel where Selena again demanded the financial papers, and she told her she could not be trusted. At 11:48 a.m., Yolanda drew the gun from her purse and pointed at Selena. Seeing the gun, Selena attempted to flee. Yolanda shot her once in the right lower shoulder, severing an artery, resulting in a massive loss of blood. Critically wounded, Selena ran towards the lobby, leaving a trail of blood. She collapsed on the floor as the clerk called 911, with Yolanda still chasing after her and yelling at her, "Bitch!" Selena clutched her chest, screaming, help me, I've been shot. Before collapsing, she named Yolanda as her assailant and gave the number of the room where she had been shot. Selena's condition began to deteriorate rapidly as motel staff attended to her. A staff member tried to talk to her, but noted that she began fading away. He stated that she was moaning and moving less. An ambulance arrived at the scene less than 2 minutes later. The paramedics applied a Vaseline gloss to Selena's wound, which stopped the surface bleeding, and the paramedic performed cardiopulmonary resuscitation to keep her blood circulating. Meanwhile, Yolanda got into her pickup truck and attempted to leave the motel. Why? Why did she do it? Honestly, like, but what leads you to do that? Because she was so close to her. So I do have more details of what was going on with Yolanda, the woman that stopped everybody from naming their child Yolanda since 95. Yolanda was the youngest of eight children born to Frank and Juanita Salivar in San Antonio, Texas. While growing up, she was teased and occasionally bullied at school because of her weight. She rarely made any friends, isolated herself from social activities. Her father was a head waiter at Jacala, a Mexican restaurant in West End. She attended three different elementary schools in Edgewood School District. Yolanda first attended Kennedy High School, then transferred to Holmes, followed by High School before graduating in 1979 from McCollum High School. So she moved around a lot, it sounds like, so probably had a hard time making any real permanent friends. At McCollum High, she actually joined junior ROTC. So Yolanda was accepted at the University of Texas in 1985, then transferred to Palo Alto College, where she studied to be a registered nurse, which I had no idea. So on December 10th, 1990, she received a Bachelor's of Science in Nursing from Texas A&M International University. At this time, she became obsessed with losing weight. She also began work as a graduate nurse at Medical Center Hospital, eventually earning her license as an RN from the Texas Board of Nurse Examiners, making $60,000 a year, which in 1990, that's really good, $60,000. So eventually she was married and moved to part-time work after adopting three children, which one was her niece. So this is kind of the beginning of hearing problematic behaviors from her. One of Yolanda's employers, Dr. Faustino Gomez, a dermatologist, sued her for $9,200 that he said she stole from him starting in 1983. The lawsuit was eventually settled out of court. Within 2 months, Yolanda was back in court when the Texas Guaranteed Student Loan Corporation obtained a Travis County Gorge judgment in Austin against her for failing to repay a student loan of $7,361. But to her defense, fuck school loans. So at that time, Yolanda had switched jobs and she was working as a nurse at a St. Luke's Lutheran Hospital. Just to summarize, early 1980s. She was already getting in trouble for essentially embezzling and stealing. So in the next 4 years, Yolanda worked at two other hospitals. However, she started to get bored with working in healthcare. Having become a fan of Tejano music, she attended a Shelly Lattice concert in San Antonio and approached the singer about starting a fan club. And Lattice's father, Fred, said, "That's a big no for me, dog," and would only approve family members to work with the singer. So Yolanda was convinced by friends to give Selena a try, although she didn't really like the singer because she dominated the Tejano Music Award. So I guess she was like, oh, she's too big and commercialized, whatever. She was already a hater from the get-go. But after attending a concert, her views changed. She approached Selena's father, Abraham, about starting a fan club in San Antonio. He approved, and she immediately became the club's president. Later, she became the manager of her boutiques, which we'll talk about. By 1993, the fan club had reached 1,500 members in less than 4 years and eventually grew to over 5,000, becoming one of the largest fan clubs in San Antonio area. As Selena's success grew, her relationship with Yolanda blossomed, which she then earned more responsibility. She was hired to manage her design houses, boutique stores. She even had a set of keys to Selena's house. In early 1994, Selena opened up Selena Etc. Boutique, and I think it was pretty much after she was discriminated in that mall. I don't know if you remember, Nao, in that scene where she went to the mall to buy like Grammy dress, and that hating ass bitch was like, "You can't afford that," or some shit. And all of a sudden, she saw this like the crowd be like, "Selena's here," and then she felt stupid. So, suck it. She opened her own,
and she was like, "Thanks, we won't be needing it anymore." Walked out with class. Out of my face.
Yes. That was amazing. And I think such like a badass move of, all right, I don't belong in this realm. I'm gonna make my own. And I'm gonna make it for our people, which I like resonates so hard because I feel like that's what we're doing, right? We're like, all right, I got you. Like, you're gonna make me try to earn a spot 10 times more than what you deserve. But we'll make our own table. We'll make our own boutique. We'll make our own Selena, etc. So she did that and hired Yolanda to manage the chain. 8 months later, she signed Yolanda as a registered agent in San Antonio, Texas, which I feel like I think is equivalent in the military. They call it like the power of attorney. Like, they're there to essentially sign off on everything on your behalf. Quintanilla family believe Yolanda was the best choice due to her excellent job in boosting the membership of the Selena fan club to over 400,000 at that time, where she was able to organize special events, help Selena deal with admirers at public events. So eventually, after being hired for the boutiques, Yolanda moved to Corpus Christi to be closer to Selena. Yolanda's room was covered with Selena posters and pictures. I don't know if they showed this in the movie. I don't remember. It's been a while.
I don't remember, but I would want to say that that would probably make sense.
Yeah. She had pictures and posters, burning votive candles, and a library of Selena videos, which she used to entertain guests. During an interview with Yolanda in 1995, interviewers of the Dallas Morning News believed that Yolanda's devotion to Selena bordered on obsessive. So the outside was seeing, like, okay, that's more than just being her, like, business partner slash fan club president. So Yolanda then began to start telling the staff that she wanted to be just like Selena. Okay. Around this time, Selena gave Yolanda her American Express card to conduct company business. With that, Yolanda rented Lincoln Town cars, traveled to and from Mexico, entertained associates in fancy restaurants, and purchased two cell phones she carried. In 1990s, like, what you need two phones for? Like, get out of here. She then started to alter Ellen Tracy designer jackets made for the boutiques, which I guess, I don't know what that means, making them backing up her authority to do so with the card. So I don't know, she was just, power got to her head and she was like running with it. When Yolanda became a business associate, in addition to being her friend, her relationship with Selena began to fall apart. Staff members at Selena, etc., complained that Yolanda was always nice when Selena was around, but when Selena was gone, Yolanda treated everyone terribly and was a huge asshole. In January 1995, Deborah Ramirez, Selena's cousin, was hired to work in the boutiques to help Selena expand the fashion venture into Mexico. Ramirez quit within a week, telling Yolanda that she was not happy and was dissatisfied with how staff members failed to report their sales. Yolanda replied that it was not Ramirez's business and she would take care of it. Martin Gomez, a fashion designer for Selena, complained that Yolanda was mismanaging Selena's affairs, and he even believed that Yolanda was sabotaging his work. Like, he would leave his designs and, like, his stuff around and leave for the day, and he'd find his shit ripped up or cut up. And he also claimed that she didn't pay any of the bills, so she was not nice. When Yolanda visited the factory in Mexico, because like Neo had mentioned, Selena was looking to expand in Monterrey, Mexico. Yolanda intimidated seamstresses by telling them to either leave or side with her. Gomez tried to convince Selena that Yolanda was bad news, but he says that Yolanda claimed he was exaggerating. And a few weeks later, Yolanda asked employees to help pay for a gift. If you remember, it was that big diamond encrusted egg ring that she gave. So Philip Randolph helped design the ring and noticed that Yolanda not want Selena to know that she had bought anything, but she did not want Selena to know the cost of how much it was. I think Selena would have been like, how are you paying for this? You know, even though it was a gift for me, like, I think that would have like raised questions. So she like, she didn't want anybody to know that it was from her. So I don't know if that was in the movie. But I know she got that ring, though. Is it bad in the movie? I was like, that ring is not cute. Maybe because I knew it came from Yolanda. I was like, fuck her. You could do better, Selena.
I just Googled it, and I think it's the first image that comes up that she's wearing that ring. So, this lady's so sus.
So then, December 1994, the boutiques began to really suffer. Staff at both stores had been reduced from 38 to 14, largely because Yolanda fired anyone that she did not like personally, which is like fucking everybody because she sucks. The remaining employees began to complain to Selena about Yolanda. Selena did not believe that her friend would do anything to hurt her or her business because Selena is a good person and obviously believes in the best of people. And obviously it's hard to believe something that you don't see yourself too, right? Because Yolanda was manipulating the shit out of her. The employees then began to take their concerns to Selena's father, Abraham, who cautioned Selena that Yolanda might be a bad influence. But even with that, Selena did not suspect anything because her father always distrusted people or was more cautious, obviously, because he had to protect his whole family and their brand and their business. So she was like, okay, I hear you, but but kind of like brushed it off. So on March 9th, 1995, Selena and her father and her sister Suzette had a closed meeting at Q Productions with Yolanda. Abraham presented Yolanda with inconsistencies concerning disappearing funds. So they had found out through paperwork and all that stuff that she was fucking up. Abraham stated that Yolanda simply stared at him and didn't answer any of his questions. He told Yolanda that he was going to pursue the matter legally. And again, she just gave a dead ass look to him, gave no response. And then Suzette accused Yolanda of being a liar and a thief. The next morning, Eddie, Selena's uncle and her dad's brother, called him to let him know that Yolanda had shown up at Q Productions with Lori Roth, another employee. Abraham drove to Q Productions and informed Yolanda that she was no longer welcome on the premises. The same day, Selena and Yolanda engaged in an intense argument over the phone. Selena hung up and told Chris that she could no longer trust Yolanda. However, she did not want to dissolve their friendship, especially since Yolanda was essential to whether the clothing line was going to take off in Mexico. She wanted to keep her close because she possessed bank records, statements of financial records necessary for preparing taxes. On March 13th, 1995, the day after Yolanda was banned from Q Productions, she went to a place to shoot, a gun shop and range house in South San Antonio. So this is exactly what Nao had mentioned earlier, just a little more detailed. She bought a Taurus 45 snub nose and a 38 caliber revolver, which are huge fucking ammos. Like, that's big old guns. I've shot those. Yolanda told the clerk that she needed protection for her job as an in-house nurse care for terminally ill patients because a patient's relatives had threatened her. You fucking liar. 2 days later, Selena asks Yolanda to accompany her on a Monterrey, Mexico tour. Yolanda then returned the handgun to the shop, claiming that her father had given her a 22 caliber pistol. So during the trip, Selena began pressuring Yolanda to return the bank statements. So when they got back, Yolanda bought the gun again. Okay, so she bought it, returned it, bought it again. What the fuck? Okay, the following week, Yolanda's name was removed as chief executive officer for Selena Design House Incorporated and was replaced as fan club president by Irene Herrera. On March 26, 1995, Yolanda stole a perfume sample and more bank statements from Selena, Mexico. On the 29th of March, she told Dr. Ricardo Martinez, Selena's primary care physician, that she had been raped, but he did not believe her as he had been informed by Selena's family that Yolanda and Selena's relationship was beginning to deteriorate. So she fucking told Selena's doctor? Like, what the fuck?
I'm so weirded out by that, because already it's like, does that sound like splitting and like triangulating, kind of? I don't know.
Yes, and like, yeah, absolutely, just manipulation, right, of trying to do whatever she can to keep that control and bringing in everybody. So that's where essentially shit went down. So essentially what I'm going to cover now is a standoff. For hours after the shooting, Yolanda remained in a standoff with police. She sat in her pickup truck in the motel parking lot and held the gun to her head, which was depicted in the movie. That's when Larry Rucker Young, a lead negotiator with the Corpus Christi Police Department, got involved. He tells A&E Real Crime, "I was on the phone with her for 7.5 hours. Oh, hell no. I'd been like, listen, bitch. How dare you? Goodbye. Yolanda didn't ask for anything. What she wanted, really, was to hear what was going on with Selena, her condition. How dare you? You fucking shot her and you want to know how she's doing. As mentioned, Selena had been declared dead at Corpus Christi Memorial Hospital at 1:05 p.m., less than 90 minutes after she had been shot. But Rucker, sensing the mental state that Yolanda was in, elected to not tell her. He says she wanted someone to hear her story, that they were best friends, that she loved Selena, admired her, and she would do anything for her. This pisses me off. Just the audacity of, like, just this reality, like we've talked about with the Jodi Arias story and case. Just the denial and this like false perception and different plane of reality that they're in. Crazy what the brain does. Yolanda's trial for the murder of Selena was followed closely by the Latino community in the U.S. The trial was not televised, but cameras were allowed outside the courthouse. Eventually, the venue or the court sessions were moved to Houston, Texas, after Yolanda's lawyer successfully argued that she could not receive a fair trial in Selena's hometown. Which is probably true. I mean, and that's with a lot of killers, that there is a bias, essentially, if, you know, a person that has been loved by the community. So before the start of the trial, CNN reported that prosecutors were expected to introduce a controversial police confession signed by Yolanda, in which she said she shot Selena during an argument over accusations from the singer's father that Yolanda stole money from Selena's accounts. The defense was expected to introduce testimony from Texas Ranger Robert Garza that he overheard Yolanda claim the shooting was accidental and that she had objected when police failed to include it in her statement. The defense attorney argued the shooting was accidental, but the prosecution pointed out that Yolanda, a trained nurse, neither called 911 nor did she try to help Selena after she was shot. Yolanda claimed that the gun accidentally went off. However, it was shown that the pistol, a 5-shot, 38 caliber revolver, required 11 pounds of pressure on the trigger to fire it, which can only occur when the trigger is intentionally pulled. And I, Mal, myself, have shot a 38 caliber revolver. My husband had one. We used to practice on the range legally. And that shit is hard. Like, it's not one that you hear usually goes off that often by itself. So the judge did not give the jury the option of lesser charges of manslaughter or negligent homicide, and the juries were told they must convict or acquit Yolanda on the sole charge of first degree murder. So pretty much he was saying that I don't fucking buy it, that it was an accident. You're not getting manslaughter or negligent homicide. He was obviously a Selena fan. No, I'm just kidding. Allegedly, in my opinion. Don't sue me. But thank you, judge. So he said either get her on first degree or not, because we don't play that shit, right?
Yeah, that makes sense, because I mean, at this point, like, I don't know, it even sounds like premeditated. Like, why would you purchase a gun? Why would you show it to her and then return it and then bring it back again?
Why did you have it out, bitch? Why was it out? Why did you have it out for it to accidentally shoot at her back? And I think in that really corroborated the story of Selena was running away. She took the weapon out to threaten her, and Selena saw it and was like, fuck that, proceeded to run out of the room, and she shot her while she was running away. So that's not accidental. And yeah, absolutely, like, that was not a crime of passion, because homegirl had it out already. So fuck you, Yolanda. Anyways. So the jury was not here for it either, because they deliberated for 2 fucking hours and found that she was guilty of murder. So goodbye. She received the maximum sentence, but hear this. She will be eligible for parole in March
2025. That is less than 4 years. I don't know how to feel about that. Like, what?
That's in 4 years. Actually, you're like, oh, it's Texas. Why was she not given the death penalty? Because, you know, that's Texas. So, a death sentence was not an option for the jury because the case does not include any of the aggravating factors necessary under Texas's death penalty statute, reports the New York Times. So I guess it didn't meet the criteria for getting the death penalty, which I don't know what the criteria is. Maybe we can look it up, because killing Selena should be it.
That should be it, yeah. That should be one of the stipulations. That should be it. Stipulations.
Because Jodi Arias, she was found guilty of capital murder, and the death penalty was on the table, but the jury decided to not give it to her. Because John Battaglia got it, thankfully. So, according to Tarleton Law, University of Texas, if an individual is convicted of a capital felony, he or she may be subject to a punishment by death if the state sought such a punishment. A capital felony is one in which an individual intentionally or knowingly causes the death of an individual under special circumstances, in particular, the murder of a public safety officer, firefighter in line of duty, murder during the commission of specified felonies, kidnapping, burglary, robbery, aggravated rape, arson, murder for remuneration, multiple murders, murder during prison escape, murder of a correctional officer, murder of a judge, murder of a state prison inmate who's serving life, murder of an individual under 6 years of age. Okay, so she didn't meet any of those, where John Battaglia met it because he killed his daughters. I don't think one was under six, but I mean, that's fucking child murder. Based on this, that's why she didn't get the death penalty, because it didn't fall under any of those circumstances. But it should be murder of Selena in there, like we were saying. Of course, she tried to appeal. Eventually, she entered the woman's prison 110 miles southwest of Dallas and 250 miles north of Corpus Christi on November 28, 1995, where this facility housed 1,800 women prisoners. And it doesn't end. Like, her bullshit does not end while she's in jail. When she began her jail term, she allegedly would soon say something about the truth that she knew about Selena. This woman not only fucking killed the everybody's princess and amazing person, she continued to sully her fucking reputation and her name by saying that something fucked up happened and she knew about Selena. The television network VH1 interviewed Yolanda in 1998 and she told them that a deposit box in Mexico contained some sort of information about Selena. There was no fucking box. So post-trial in jail, during an interview with 2020, Yolanda told reporter Deborah Roberts that, "I did not kill Selena. The shooting was accidental and my conscience is clear." Fuck you. She also told Roberts that she had intended to commit suicide and had wanted to tell Selena that she could no longer work for her. Bitch, you were being fired. What? Or you were already fired. What do you mean? Like,
it's such a strange thing to say that your conscience is clear. Like, because if it was accidental,
you would feel like shit. I think
there would be some kind of survivor's guilt. Yeah, like some survivor's guilt, some kind of something. You're not just like, no, well, I didn't do it intentionally, so I'm good. Like, weren't you such best friends with her?
You took her life away.
Like, weren't you so close to her? Yeah, like, wouldn't you feel type of way that you accidentally, in quotation marks, in her words, murdered her in cold blood?
Yeah, how can your conscience be clear?
We're upset. We need a break. We'll be back in a 30-minute intermission.
Never. I'm done. We're done. It's been a good ride. I don't want to talk about it anymore. Selena will forever be honored, but I don't know. I don't know why we're doing this. I don't know. Why did we open this? This wound I'm not ready to talk about. No, I think it's time. So yeah, she told her she could no longer work for her, and Yolanda claimed to Roberts that Selena had gone to her knees and begged, "Mom, we have to talk about this." Selena's mother, Marcella, told Roberts that the family doubted that Selena would ever call Yolanda mom. Like, get the fuck out of here. And then Yolanda continued to claim that following this exchange, Selena got up and walked at an angle towards the door to open it, and said that she then pointed the gun away from her towards the door, telling Selena to close the door. And at that instant, the gun went off. When asked if she had known at the moment that Selena had been shot, she responded that she had not. Roberts then told her that there was blood all over the room, and she said she wasn't looking at the door. She was just trying to find Selena.
And homegirl, like, what happens when you point a gun at somebody and you stop them from being able to exit a room? You're keeping them,
right?
What's the word? Hostage. Either way, girl, like, it was not going to end up well for you.
No, not at all. Yeah, not at all. And I've, like, watched a lot of FBI, whatever, and, like, interrogations and kind of, like, how to find out if people are lying. And, of course, it's not a complete science to it. Just the story that she has already made up in her mind to justify her actions and put the blame on Selena is almost telling. Because she's like, well, and then she walked in a certain angle, and then I wasn't looking at the door when I was pointing at it, so I didn't see the blood. Like, fuck yourself. She continues to tell Roberts that she never stole any money from the fan club. However, Selena's dad, Abraham, told Roberts, the same reporter, that they have proof that she stole over $100,000 from Selena, and that Yolanda was stalking Selena by telephone. And during that same interview, when Yolanda was asked why she needed a gun, she insisted that it was because Abraham had threatened her with her life, which is not true. So forensic psychologist Dr. Reed Monlor studied Robert's interview with Yolanda and told Roberts that Yolanda shows signs of obsessive compulsive disorder throughout the interview. Again, so he did not assess her himself. He is basing it on just the story that she's telling and how she's presenting, and obviously based on the DSM. And he also told Roberts that she most likely has a personality disorder. When the tape was played, Dr. Monlor was intrigued by Yolanda's response to the question, which was, "If you could go back to March 31st, 1995, what would you do differently?" Yolanda replied, "I would want her to kill me." Monlor told Roberts that Yolanda had a homicidal impulse. So after the interview, Yolanda told reports that she wanted to appeal, stating that the police had ignored her statements about the shooting being accidental. No, boo, that's not how appeals work. The jury found you fucking guilty. Yolanda requested that the Texas Court of Criminal Appeals review a petition challenging her conviction. She claims the petition was filed in 2000 with the 214th District Court, but was never sent to the higher court. Her request was received on March 31st, 2008, the 13th year anniversary of Selena's murder. The gun that was used to kill Selena was later destroyed and the pieces thrown into Corpus Christi Bay in 2002 under a judge's order, despite protests from historians. I am fine with that. We don't need to see a fucking gun that killed Selena.
I agree. And it's kind of like with Trayvon Martin was murdered by George Zimmerman, right? What does this man go on to do? Auction the gun that he used to murder him. Just wrong. That's not right. And going back to the statement that Yolanda said about, I wish she would have killed me. So either way, you wanted to antagonize her. You wanted to antagonize Selena. You wanted to make her seem like she was the bad guy. No, I don't think so.
Right. Like, and to make it about herself again, right? Like, and then she would be the victim and then Selena would then be the guilty one. And yeah, like you said, the bad guy. And there's some more info about her during that VH1 Behind the Music interview. She kept talking about this person named Lorenzo Salinas, stating that Selena wasn't the person everyone thought she was. The reporter had retrieved mailed-in letters that Yolanda and her parents claimed to be from this Lorenzo person. In one, the letter writes of Lorenzo's conscience being torn because he knows the truth. He argues in the letter that the information could help Yolanda be released from prison. He stated that he feels remorseful for Yolanda because he had beaten her. The Texas Department of Correction confirmed that the letters were sent from Mexico, but the VH1 reporter tried unsuccessfully for 7 months to find his whereabouts or even confirm his existence. Lorenzo, as Yolanda claims, was a businessman that had worked with Selena in Mexico in early 1995. She claimed that 2 weeks prior to the murder, she discovered videotapes damaging to Selena's career. Fuck you. You don't talk about her like that.
It's like Casey Anthony and like Zanny yeah. and Nanny.
Yes.
That she eventually confessed to that she doesn't even exist. So Lorenzo, poor homie, he could have been like a honest, hardworking man that they probably.
So, So in the second letter, this Lorenzo wrote that he was hired by a third party to brutally beat Yolanda to retrieve the tapes as a plot to exploit Selena. Yolanda claimed that she was attacked but managed to get away.
Usually tapes like that come up sooner or later.
All of a sudden there's these tapes and this guy. And so Yolanda tells the reporter, the VH1 reporter Jim Forbes, that she has tapes and a diary stashed in a safe deposit box in Monterey, Mexico. Forbes and the defense attorney of Yolanda went to Mexico and reportedly went to every storage facility that Yolanda and her parents had told them to search. There was no evidence of any tapes or diary. And eventually, after that, her defense attorney removed himself as counsel for Yolanda after they returned. Because he was like, oh, hell to the nah. Yeah, so that's all I have to say about her. So hopefully that brings a little more insight. And just talking about the OCD and personality disorder part, obviously perked my interest because of most episodes that we do, we've discussing what mental health issues are these people dealing with. Because again, it doesn't justify, but it helps us understand and have more insight with these personalities. And I think in addition to these disorders, the life situation or the events that happen, like, combined. So for OCD, I think it would be good to kind of go into what OCD is. Media and society, we talk about OCD in a very trivial, minimized way, right? When like you hear people go organized or clean, they're like, oh, I have OCD. But it's like, no, B, if you're functioning and you leave your house within 10 minutes, you don't have OCD. And not to minimize people, but you know what I mean? Like, I think we have to understand what OCD really looks like and the struggles of it. OCD stands for Obsessive Compulsive Disorder. So that is one specific disorder. Obsessions are defined by recurrent and persistent thoughts, urges, or images that are experienced at some time during the disturbance as intrusive and unwanted, and that in most individuals cause marked anxiety or distress. So if you're having thoughts and urges and images that continue to come that are giving you stress and anxiety. And then second is the individual attempts to ignore, suppress such thoughts, urges, images or neutralize them with some other thought or action. So if you're doing something to make those thoughts, images, and urges go away. So that's obsessive. Then compulsions are defined by repetitive behaviors, example, hand washing, ordering, checking, organizing, or doing mental acts like praying, counting, repeating words silently that the individual feels driven to perform in response to an obsession or according to rules that must be applied rigidly. The second is the behaviors or mental acts are aimed at preventing or reducing anxiety or distress or preventing some dreaded event or situation. However, these behaviors or mental acts are not connected in a realistic way with what they are designed to neutralize or prevent or are clearly excessive. So, and to note, young children may not be able to articulate the aims of behaviors or mental acts, but kids also can be diagnosed with OCD. So just to summarize that, if the person is checking to lock the doors 10 times so that their mom doesn't die, like that falls under that behavior of not connecting to a realistic way because those don't connect, you know. Then you specify with good or fair. And so how much does a person identify with their obsessive compulsive tendencies? So it's good, fair, insight, poor, and then absent, insight, delusional beliefs. So with all that being said, do you believe Yolanda has any OCD traits based on that interview that doctor watched?
I don't think I can comment on it since I didn't see the interview myself or what kind of like doctor saw that I guess led to him to that conclusion. But he had referenced like the statements that she was making, right?
Yeah.
So
the only thing he said is she showed signs of OCD throughout the interview. But in that interview, she was just, that's based more on observing her behaviors, right? And that I could connect with it.
I think I would have to like see it and sit down with it and
watch the.
Absolutely. That's going to be our homework.
I know, right? I should have. Same. I feel like without seeing the interview of like what he views to determine she's exhibiting any OCD tendencies, because that's kind of hard to see, I feel like, if she's just sitting down. So a lot of the things that would show OCD behaviors, she would have to be saying, like she would have to be self-reporting. I don't know if that would be something that was relevant to what was going on for her, because if she was just talking about Selena and all that stuff, unless she was saying, I don't know. You know, the work that we've been doing with the other episodes, again, not enough information, so I can't speak to that. And I don't want people to think, oh, well, she was obsessive with her DSM criteria-wise. That's not what they're defining as obsessive. Obsessive really is more with the OCD criteria is the behaviors that you have to do and, like, the thought. And it has to essentially be connected with some other stuff that I had mentioned earlier. So, I don't know. We need more information. I can't speak to that, but I feel like I'm comfortable saying like she meet criteria for a personality disorder. I definitely see that in her history of stealing money and having this grandiose sense of importance. So what I'm looking at, and let me know what your thoughts, Nao, is narcissistic personality disorder, where there's a pervasive pattern of grandiosity in fantasy or behavior, need for admiration, lack of empathy. So for her, I think she does have a grandiose sense of self-importance, but she being the manager.
Looks like she has like a persistent pattern of mistreating others, which ultimately leads to a murder.
Yes, yep. She's very arrogant, so shows arrogant, haughty behaviors or attitudes per DSM-5. Lacks empathy, because this bitch still lacks empathy after murdering Selena. And interpersonally exploitative. She exploits a lot. Interpersonally exploitative, taking advantage of others to achieve his or her own ends, which is absolutely what she did from the get-go, connecting with Selena. A little bit of a histrionic too, though. I wouldn't put on a full diagnosis, but to explore histrionic, because I don't think we've talked about that, our listeners, but histrionic personality disorder essentially is a pervasive pattern of excessive emotionality and attention seeking beginning by early adulthood and presents in a variety of contexts. So some of it shows self-dramatization, an exaggerated expression of emotion, considers relationships to be more intimate than they actually are, and is uncomfortable in situations which he or she is not the center of attention. So if you know anybody like that, I'm just kidding. But yeah, I just wanted to mention that. I can probably see one or two traits of that in Yolanda.
Is that the one where they also give like more meaning to a relationship than what it actually means? Than what it actually is?
Yeah. Oh, yeah, that's a good one. Let me see. Yeah, it's number 8. So considers relationships to be more intimate than they actually are. I can definitely see that in regards to, like, if, you know, she's a business partner and she's doing well. And that's what Selena, her family, seeing her is, like, someone that's good with business. But then in her mind, she's like, I'm her mom now. She can't do this without me. And we're BFFs. No, you're not. Oh, maybe. All right, so there's a difference. Maybe after we did all that fucking research, maybe he's seeing, because I don't know if this has been a change from, I mean, DSM 1995 is probably what, DSM 3 or 4. In the 5, there's obsessive compulsive personality disorder. So maybe that's what he was alluding to, where it's a preoccupation with orderliness, perfection, mental and interpersonal control, the sense of flexibility, openness, and efficiency. So being preoccupied with perfectionism, overconscious and inflexible about things, being excessively devoted to work and productivity, to the inclusion of leisure activities and friendships. So maybe being like obsessed with her shows rigid. Yeah, so maybe.
A devoted manager, but it sounds like she was really treating herself at the expense of Selena's profits. Because you know how you say she was like rolling in Lincolns and like going out and treating out like these execs. Like, I think with OCPD, like the preoccupation is very fixated on productivity and like there's no other way around it. Like A, B, C, and D, and that's my way or the highway. And you're like, hold on, man. Like, it's okay if you type the Word document and then turn it into a PDF. It's okay. Like,
mm-hmm. I gotcha.
But it's hard because that's not the way that their brain is wired. And so I don't know. I'm feeling a little iffy about this one. Also with the fact that we can't find this dude. We got to talk with somebody at Murderpedia.
Weird, weird, weird. Where are you getting your sources? Well, it's funny because I actually found, I don't know if it's like the official publishing, but so I'm going to cite the Gutenberg.org website because they have all that information that was on Murderpedia. I think this is the original source. So it's the title, Murder of Selena. The author is the World Heritage Encyclopedia. So that's Yolanda. I'm done talking about her, whatever. So Selena's family and her former band, Los Dinos, held a tribute concert a week after the 10th anniversary of her murder on April 7th, 2005. The concert entitled Selena Vive was broadcast live on Univision, achieved a 35.9 household rating, which I imagine is crazy high. It was the highest rated and most viewed Spanish language television special in the history of American television. The special was also number one program regardless of language among adults 18 to 34 in Los Angeles, Chicago, and San Francisco, while tying for first in New York, beating the night's episode of Fox's American Idol. Among Hispanic viewers, Selena Vive outperformed the Super Bowl, Giants versus Patriots.
Soy tu dueña.
Considered the most watched NFL season ever among Hispanics. In 1997, Selena was honored with a museum,
a bronze life-size statue, Mirador de la Flor,
in Corpus Christi, Texas, which is visited by hundreds of fans each week. And during the 16th anniversary of her murder, on March 31st, 2011, Selena was given a statue in Apodaca, Nuevo León.
More than 50,000 people attended her funeral service to pay their respects. I think at the time there was also rumors that she might still be alive, so it's kind of, unfortunately, the family had to clear that up. And even had an open casket to prove that she had indeed passed away. Even after all these years that Selena passed away, she is still a big cultural icon. According to biography, Dream of You came out after her death and debuted at number one on the US Billboard 200 chart, a first for a Latin artist. 1997 biopic starting with Jennifer Lopez, which is the movie that we're referencing to. I think that's the only one that's approved by the family to talk about her life. And then it says actress and singer Selena Gomez is named after her. And there is a MAC makeup collection inspired by Selena, which came out in 2016. So because of Selena, Tejanos, Texas, Latinx, Latinos, Latinas, Mexican Americans, however you choose to identify, we have an icon and an idol. And because of her and because of the movie, we will never stop saying todo por Salinas ese. And I really wish that would have happened in real life because it was such a funny moment in the movie. And it's like...
No, it did happen.
It did happen? What? I tried to see if it was a real life event.
Yes.
Ah, that's awesome.
That was a fact. Yes, there are three things that I saw just recently on Instagram where it was talking about it. That was a fact that legit happened. The mall event happened. What didn't happen, the scene where Selena's mom was dancing, and then Selena was like dancing, and she's like, oh, this the washing machine move. Abraham said, we did spend time as a family at the lake. That was the essence.
That's awesome. I mean, so much Selena is an icon that George W. Bush declared April 16, which is her birthday, Selena Day. So, you know, we all stay up late at night singing to Dreaming of You in the dark in our rooms, hoping that our crush or our partners will sing it back to us. We wake up every Saturday morning super early to Baila Esta Cumbia when our parents are up early at the crack of dawn for some reason, just starting the day cleaning up. Because of Selena, you see us wearing all the iconic outfits that she inspired and all the fashion. Because just in the movie, like she pretty much designed a lot of her onstage outfits and a lot of the fashion that she was wearing. We sing Amor Prohibido, Forbidden Love, to the top of our lungs when we think of that one person that our parents didn't let us date. And so with her songs, all of our lives have been touched and, you know, we honor Selena. Y siempre te llevamos en el corazón. We always carry you in our hearts. So rest in paradise, queen. You changed all of our lives.
Beautifully said. Thank you. And I'm going to go. She is forever around. And I think it's such a beautiful thing that we still see the generations, the younger generations, know who she is. Because she's touched so many different generations. I'm honored that we can provide this space to continue her legacy and speak to just the good-hearted, amazing person that she was and her family, too. They worked so hard to where they were at the peak of her career, so.
Yeah, we're gonna have to take, like, some breathers after this. Yeah, but, you know, like Mal said, this is, we want to offer the space and time to talk about meaningful people like this. Especially when they're impacted by, you know, murder and all these things that are just terrible. And this is exactly what was depicted in today's episode. So if you have any questions about Selena or if you would like for us to talk about anything more specific, give us a shout out. Because I know that definitely as soon as Mao asked, hey, you want to do an episode? So I was like, yes, yes, yes. Any day, any time. Just tell me and I'll be there. So keep tuning in, folks. We're excited to have you, and thank you for still following us every week with a new episode.
Absolutely. And I wanted to give you guys an update, too. We changed podcast platforms. So if you scroll all the way to the bottom in our show notes, I don't know how to make it higher, so I apologize. But on the podcast episode, you can click on that link, and it'll bring you to a spot where you can record a voice message for us. So it goes up to a minute. So you can let us know your thoughts or give us some feedback or suggestions on what you want to hear. We would love to hear from you. And if you want to be featured in the podcast, we may do that. So again, hit us up via show notes. We have our Instagram linked and our email linked to that. So you can just go straight to that. And thank you for tuning in, and we love you.
Till next time, homies.
Keep it real.
Peace.
Thank you for joining us, and be sure to come back next week where we continue to explore true crime, psychology, the paranormal, mental health, and everything in between. We would love to hear from you, so email us at millennialtherapistspod@gmail.com with your ghost stories, paranormal experiences, questions about therapy and counseling, or the social work field. And don't forget to share, subscribe, and review wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.
Remember, you are valued, you are enough,
and you are not alone.
Please subscribe and review. Bye-bye.
Although we are licensed mental health therapists and may cover therapy-related subjects, the topics in this podcast should not substitute professional, psychological, or medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment.
If you are a victim of a crime, which includes but not limited to stalking, human trafficking, financial crimes, or sexual assault, please know the Victim Connect Resource Center can help. They are a referral helpline where crime victims can learn about their rights and options confidentially and compassionately. A traditional telephone-based helpline is 1-855-4-VICTIM or 1-855-484-2846. Or you can connect with them at chat.victimconnect.org or at the website victimconnect.org.
If you or someone you know is in crisis, whether they are considering suicide or not, please call the toll-free lifeline available 24/7 across the United States by calling 1-800-273-8255 or visit suicidepreventionlifeline.org. U.S. and Canadian listeners can also text HOME to 741-741 to connect with a trained crisis counselor. UK listeners text HOME to 85258 and Ireland listeners text HOME to 50808. For more mental health resources and support, international listeners can visit the website unitedgmh.org/mental-health-support to find more mental health services and resources.
And if you are a veteran in crisis or concerned about one, connect with the Veteran Crisis Line to reach caring, qualified responders with the Department of Veterans Affairs at 1-800-273-8255 and press 1, or text 838-255. Or you can always visit veteranscrisisline.net.
If you or anyone you know may be experiencing domestic violence, you can find resources and support with the National Domestic Violence Hotline. Visit thehotline.org or call 1-800-799-7233.